91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Feeling sad and depressed is a frequent reaction to a stressful life situation. It's normal to feel down after a major disappointment, a death, or to have trouble sleeping or eating after a relationship breakup. Good afternoon, it's Joseph Cooper. In the past two decades, though, 120 million Americans have filled antidepressant medicine prescriptions. That adds up to $10 billion. Today, I'm joined by practicing psychotherapist Gary Greenberg, who brings unique perspective. He suffered from depression and also took part in a clinical trial of antidepressants. He's written Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Stay with us. Topical Currents is next after NPR and regional news. And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Well, many famous people have suffered from depression, from Hans Christian Andersen to Virginia Woolf, Lincoln. But in the past 20 years or so, the numbers of people diagnosed with the malady has risen greatly. We see TV and magazine ads that offer prescription drugs for depression and are told to ask our doctors. But if we're sad and unhappy, should we take medications to alter brain chemistry? Joining me now is psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg. His latest book is Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Gary Greenberg joins us from Willimantic, Connecticut, one of my favorite towns. Welcome, Gary.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, something that struck me in your book is you said that depression has expanded like Walmart. 30 million Americans take antidepressants, and that's $10 billion a year, considerable sum.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing.
A considerable sum.
Yes, that's a lot of money.
So, expanding like Walmart, when did it really start, and what caused the mushrooming of depression diagnoses?
Well, you can trace it back to a few points in history, the most significant and most recent of which is the invention and marketing of Prozac in the late 1980s and early 1990s. It was at that point that depression increasingly came to be seen as a widespread problem, sort of a public health problem. And a lot of that has to do with increased attempts to detect depression, using instruments, tests, and so on, that whether they were designed to or not, could easily result in more positive findings than the earlier tests were. There was a whole change in the way that depression was diagnosed that started in the early 1980s, and so that intersected with the marketing of the antidepressants to create both incentives for and a method to diagnose depression much more widely than it had in the past.
So, as a psychotherapist, if someone comes into your office and says, you know, I saw an ad on Zoloft and I've been feeling kind of unhappy, are you likely to just to write a prescription?
Well, I can't write prescriptions, but I'm likely to talk with that because I have a PhD,
you're a psychologist,
not an MD.
Yeah.
But in some states, PhDs can write prescriptions, just not mine. And I don't have a particular agenda against prescribing. What I would do with a person like that is to talk with them about what they learned in the ad or whatever they read or saw or heard, and try to give them some information about what I know about antidepressants and about how they intersect with the condition that that particular patient has, and talk with them about what I know about the side effects. In particular, I spend time with patients talking about whether or not how they feel about the idea of taking a drug to alter their consciousness, and whether or not they would, how they would feel if the drug made them feel so much better that they would not want to stop taking it, which is the experience in a lot of cases. And I don't say that to warn them off at all. I want them to go into the experience ready to deal with that possibility. And then, of course, I would tell them to go see their doctor.
Is it common practice to start with low dosages and slowly raise them? Or?
Well, there's different introductory regimens, but yeah, I mean, that's basically, they try to titrate. And then there's the additional confounding problem that antidepressants often take a long time to work, even after they're at what is thought of as a therapeutic dose. But the biggest reason for the slow run-up is not the effectiveness of the drug, it's the side effects.
Now, I know a number of people who had severe clinical depression, and they were greatly helped by taking Prozac or other psychotropic drugs. And you have no problem with that as far as antidepressants do work in some cases. They prevent people from suicide and make them be able to function.
Well, no, of course not. And I don't have any problem with people relieving their suffering. I think that there are two sorts of populations that respond to antidepressants. And one of them is people who are severely depressed, the kind of people who, you know, really basically can't function. And in that population, antidepressants show themselves to be moderately effective. You know, efficacy rates somewhere in the neighborhood of 60%. And they do seem to outdistance placebos with these severely depressed people. So for some of those people, antidepressants work well. Now, I should add that with severely depressed people, often they do better with the older generation of antidepressants, the ones that were invented in the late 1950s, beginning in the late 1950s.
What were those drugs?
A drug, imipramine, Elavil.
Tofranil?
Tofranil was imipramine, yeah. And these drugs are all available, and they're all, but they have a higher, I guess the best way to put it is they're more promiscuous in the brain, so they cause more side effects. And the great advantage of the later generation of drugs is that they're slightly more selectively targeted, although not as selective as we like to think they are. And so they have a lower side effect profile. In addition, there were some questions about liver toxicity with the old antidepressants, and sometimes people on them for, you know, long periods, 15, 20 years, would have to start getting liver panels, you know, blood tests to make sure that they weren't encountering those problems. So, you know, there's a trade-off. You get lower side effects, but speaking statistically, you get lower effectiveness as well. So those are the one population that seem to do well with antidepressants. And the other population, which is the more interesting and difficult to deal with, are the people who are mildly depressed, or maybe not really, technically speaking, depressed at all, but unhappy, out of sorts, irritable, worried, the walking wounded, we'll call them. And people in that category do tend to, in my clinical experience, they take the drugs and they feel better. And sometimes they think they feel better because they were sick in the first place, although that is far from clear. Often their physicians will have told them that they have a neurochemical imbalance, that the drug is correcting, but it's just as easy to think that the drug simply does something in your brain that makes you feel better. And this population we don't understand very well because the studies, the clinical trials, are not really geared to pick up what they're experiencing and in what way their lives are getting better. So, for instance, those people report feeling more confident or less rejection sensitive or less shy. And the studies that are used to approve these drugs don't really even look for that. They're looking for much more, much broader psychological symptoms.
Now, is this surge in the diagnoses of depression, is this an American phenomenon, or is it occurring in Europe or in Asia?
It's happened everywhere, and in a way, I mean, there's not a one-to-one correspondence, but you can certainly trace the rise of you can certainly trace the rise in the number of people diagnosed against the spread of the marketing and find a pretty good correspondence, and especially in a country like Japan, where in the early 90s there really was no depression to speak of. And then after a pretty concerted effort by the drug companies, which has been detailed in a very good book called Crazy Like Us, it emerged that, lo and behold, there was a lot of depression in Japan, and then suddenly the pharmaceutical industry found itself with a $1 billion-a-year market that it didn't have before.
You mentioned in the book the phrase that it's a disease manufactured to sell the cure. Explain that.
Yeah, I think that in some respects that's correct. That's not to say that, first of all, that people who suffer from what we call depression aren't really suffering. And secondly, it's not to say that there isn't some version of the disease that probably fits our standard category of disease, which is something that happens to us that we don't have any control over, that's the result of some kind of biochemical problem. But I think that that population is probably much smaller than the population of people who qualify for the diagnosis, because the diagnosis in many ways has been created around what the drugs do.
We're speaking with psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg. He's written, his latest book is Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Gary, stay with me. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
Good afternoon, and thanks for joining us for Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. On Friday, March 19th, City Year Miami, a nonprofit organization serving our local public schools, will hold its inaugural dinner, the Red Jacket Ball. Ticket information at 786-406-7900. City Year, give a year, change the world.
For more than 50 years, the Joffrey Ballet has been thrilling audiences around the world. The Chicago Sun-Times says they've got sizzling steps and killer style, says the Chicago Tribune. The Joffrey Ballet, two nights only, March 26th and 27th at the Adrian Arsch Center. The Joffrey Ballet, one of America's most exciting dance companies. Tickets at 305-949-6722 or arschcenter.org.
After captivating audiences on Broadway and London's West End, New Theatre in Coral Gables presents a limited engagement of the Tony Award-winning play Equus by Peter Schaefer. This primal and electrifying night of theatre about a young stable boy who commits an unbelievable act runs now through April 4th. Information at new-theatre.org or 305-443-5909.
And we return 18 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. And again, we're speaking with Gary Greenberg. He's a practicing psychotherapist and a journalist. He's written several books. His latest is Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. If you'd like to join in our discussion, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email is available. That's radio@wlrn.org. Gary Greenberg, tell us about how serotonin works in the brain and how SSRIs adjust the chemistry of our brain.
Well, I'll take the second question first.
Okay.
One of the things that the SSRIs, which are drugs like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, one of the things that those drugs do is they prevent this chemical called serotonin from being reabsorbed by the brain, which leaves the chemical in the brain actively for longer than it would otherwise be. And the reason that that's important is because when serotonin is active, it's stimulating certain nerve receptors in the brain. And so that stimulation occurs, I guess the best way to put it is like building a dam so that the chemical stays at the receptor for a longer period of time. Now, we know that's what it does, and that can be observed very easily, but we don't know why that would make a difference in somebody's mood. It's an empirical observation that if you give somebody a drug that tweaks their serotonin metabolism, they start to feel better. So the conclusion has been drawn, not unreasonably, but also not scientifically, that serotonin is what's responsible for mood. Now, there's just a study that came out very recently. It's not a study. It's a case report about a fellow who has a genetic problem that prevents him from being able to synthesize serotonin. He doesn't have, essentially, any serotonin in his brain. And he suffers some some appetite problems and some sleep problems and some maybe even cognitive problems, but he doesn't suffer mood problems. And there are other indications that serotonin is not necessarily the thing that causes the mood, but rather just it's somehow by changing that metabolism, you're changing something else that in turn helps people feel better. There's a theory, for instance, that it helps new nerve cells grow, that serotonin works as a kind of a miracle grow in the brain, if you will, that helps people grow new brain cells, and that those new brain cells in a certain area of the brain called the hippocampus change people's moods. But the point is that it's a black box. You take the drug, you put it in the box, and what comes out on the other side is an improved mood.
And what are the side effects most common?
The most common side effect with these drugs is sexual side effects. People find that their sex lives aren't what they once were. They have trouble achieving orgasm. In fact, that problem is so widespread that in some places these drugs are used to treat premature ejaculation in men. Unfortunately, the downside of this is that people who have difficulty with orgasm become less interested in sex. There's also indications that even absent that problem, people's sexual appetite is suppressed by the drugs. Other side effects can include, you know, jitteriness and appetite disturbance and sleep disturbance. In some cases, and this is important, these drugs, especially in the beginning, can cause what's called akathisia, which is an agitation that is thought by some people to lead to some of the suicidality that seems to accompany the use of these drugs. People become agitated, they become impulsive, they were depressed in the first place, and by adding that agitation to the picture, some people think you're increasing the likelihood of suicide or suicidal thoughts.
Now, one of the interesting aspects of your book, Manufacturing Depression, is that you yourself have suffered from depression over 25 years. You particularly had a spell after your divorce, and you were diagnosed with a major depressive disorder. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the diagnosis is fairly straightforward. It means that when asked about the 9 symptoms of depression, I had the requisite 5, and I don't know which 5 I had, but, you know, those would be like a low mood, difficulties with appetite, loss of interest in usually pleasurable activities, a kind of chronic irritability, and so on. And so what the diagnosis means is just that I met the criteria.
And I found it kind of odd. You were talking about your interaction with the therapist when you got involved in this clinical study. It's kind of odd, a therapist on therapist. What was that like?
Well, it was fun. I mean, because, you know, he wasn't really a therapist. He was a psychiatrist who specializes in neuroscience, and I'm very interested in that subject. And so all the time that we were carrying on the clinical interview, we were also talking about depression. We were talking about the biochemistry and the sort of the history of it and all of that. So that was really interesting. It was also interesting to observe the great difference between how I would have acted in his position had I been interviewing me, and the conclusion that I came to, I think that had I conducted the interview that he conducted and gotten to the numbers that he got to that led him to diagnose me with major depression, I think I would have been really tempted to question the outcome. And that's probably, it probably would disqualify me from that job because the whole point of these diagnoses is to be objective. And I would have seen the person in front of me as somebody who didn't really seem depressed, at least not depressed in the sense of major depression, which is supposed to be a fairly significant level of impairment. So, you know, whether he did the right thing or the wrong thing, I was really struck by how focused he was on the numbers, where I would have been focused on something else. And I think there's a case to be made that either one of us would have been wrong.
Now, you were part of this clinical test, and you were given medication to take. Tell us about that.
Well, I was I enrolled in a trial for major depression. I went to this originally tried to enroll in a trial for minor depression, which, by the way, I think I do have, which is a much more less malignant form of the disorder, and would have been treated if I had qualified for that trial with a drug called Celexa. But since I didn't qualify because I had major depression, I was offered a different drug. In this case, the drug was simply omega-3 fatty acids. And I took those drugs for 2 weeks at a time, and then I went back to the hospital and went through the same interview and questions over again. And I did this for 4 rounds, so it was a total of 8 weeks that I was, or 9 weeks that I was in the trial. And what happens is that after a while, you start to pay attention to the things that they're asking you about. They are asking you, do you feel guilty? Do you feel self-critical? Things like that. And you start to realize that, well, you know, I can feel guilty and self-critical, and suddenly those begin to feel like, oh, maybe these are the symptoms of a disease. And interestingly, as the trial went along, my condition, according to the numbers, was improving. I wasn't sure that I felt that, but the survey said I was getting better.
So all those thoughts about guilt and that business wasn't self-fulfilling in your case.
Say it again, I'm sorry.
It wasn't self-fulfilling, that the more you thought about guilt or
no,
other
wasn't.
Symptoms,
it
that the more you tended to have them.
The rumination, it wasn't like medical student syndrome. It didn't increase my rumination. It just made me associate certain things with pathology that I hadn't associated with pathology before. Also, and it didn't really do this for me, but I can see how it could have done it, is that it preps you for what the drugs are supposed to do. In other words, maybe you weren't thinking about your tendency to be self-critical as an issue, and now that you are, you're paying attention to whether or not the drug is making it better, and we already know that these drugs are supposed to make it better. So it's sort of like, without meaning to, it stacks the deck. I mean, these doctors don't have anything to go on except the questions they ask and the answers that you give. There's no blood test. There's no x-rays. There's nothing like that. So they're just stuck with asking you these questions.
Tell me more about this Celexa that they had you on. Is that an SS?
They had me on omega-3 fatty acids,
oh,
which is fish oil.
Well, what's the Celexa that you mentioned?
Celexa would have been the drug had I qualified for the minor depression
trial. Oh, I see.
But as it turned out, in the course of the trial, I was, you know, increasingly, I was getting better, and they were glad I was getting better, and they told me I was getting better. They even offered to continue the trial, the drugs for me afterwards. What was curious to me was, of course, nobody really knew if I was on the drug. It is, all of these trials are controlled with placebos, and so the deal is you don't know if you're on the drug or the placebo.
And neither does the therapist.
And neither does the right. No, nobody knows except the pharmacist, who doesn't have any contact with you. So it's called a double-blind study, and they don't unblind the study at the end. Well, because I had traveled a couple of times and forgotten my pills, I had extra pills. And so I sent them off to a lab after the trial was over, and it turned out I was on the placebo.
Which was the omega-3.
No, the placebo was actually soybean oil, I believe. I mean, nobody could specify, but there was no omega-3 in it. The placebo was actually omega-6, you know, the bad fatty acids. The ones that make us all get diabetes and all.
How nice.
They were trying to make me sick, I guess.
I guess. Let's see. Let's take a quick call, Gary Greenberg. This is Ray in Miami. Hi there.
Yeah, thank you, because all this show, what it's done is provoked more thought about more things. Originally, I called with the question of, well, if the whole point is to feel good, why not just a couple of bottles of sparkling wine or have some marijuana. But then it brings a second question. Is the normal human state to be perpetually happy? And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Gary.
Well, I'm glad he's going to get off the air because I have no idea how to answer that.
I think there's a difference between taking antidepressants and intoxicants.
Those are two brilliant points. I mean, and both of which I address, although not anywhere near so concisely, in my book. The first one, we have to think about something that's been called pharmacological Calvinism. And what that is a principle that nobody's ever really come out and said, okay, this is how we're going to do business. But in this country, we don't really allow people to alter their consciousness with drugs just for the heck of it. The one exception is alcohol. And that, as we know, has its problems, but it also has all sorts of strictures associated.
And coffee.
Coffee, nicotine, yeah. So I shouldn't say the one exception. There's a few exceptions, but drugs like pot and to some extent alcohol are really frowned upon. And the reason is because it's giving you a state of happiness or well-being or whatever you want to call it that you didn't earn. It's like the work ethic gets applied. And so one of the things that's happened here, I believe, is that the impetus to make all of these diagnoses, and to some extent, it comes from the desire to have a way to distribute, to prescribe and sell these drugs that doesn't run afoul of that of our pharmacological Calvinism. So the distinction, I mean, there are vast differences between the effects and the use and the meaning of these drugs, but to the extent that they're all consciousness-altering drugs, the differences are a little less distinct than we might want them to be. And if we just said, okay, these antidepressants, they just make people feel better, let's not bother calling them sick, then you'd have a real problem on your hands because you'd lose that distinction. Suddenly, the difference between Prozac and recreational drugs would be less than it is now. And you would also lose the rationale, I believe, for keeping them as prescription drugs. You might be in the position where somebody could say, well, let's just make them over the counter.
But then the doctors lose out.
Yeah, well, the doctors lose out. Maybe we all lose out. I'm not sure I want them over the counter. But you lose the rationale if you don't need a diagnosis in the first place. I mean, you don't need to go to a doctor to know to take aspirin for a headache or an over-the-counter sleep remedy or an allergy remedy. So why do you need it for one of these drugs, which, by the way, is not, it's much harder to hurt yourself with the new antidepressants than it is to hurt yourself with aspirin or Tylenol. So the second question, is it normative to be happy? I think that was what he said. How do we know that that's the normal state of, you know, that's an enormous question. And the way I would answer is to say we don't know that, but we live in a society which is dedicated to the pursuit of happiness. And depression is actually a pathology largely because people who are depressed, in addition to feeling really bad and suffering, are also stuck. They have lost the opportunity or the ability or whatever it is to pursue happiness. And that, in our society, is something that's is unique to our society. That's a real problem. So I think that the drugs come into the picture there, as does the diagnosis, largely because the norm may not be to be happy, but the norm is certainly to pursue happiness and to feel bad when you haven't achieved it.
Gary Greenberg, again, stay with me. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
This is 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM's Topical Currents. We're funded by listeners like you and by Macy's Furniture Galleries, featuring Karistan wall-to-wall carpeting. With locations in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties, Macy's Furniture Galleries strive to offer something for every room in the house with Karistan wall-to-wall carpeting.
The City of Miami Gardens presents the 5th annual Jazz in the Gardens, March 20th and 21st at Sun Life Stadium, featuring Cassandra Wilson and David Sanborn, Joe Sample, Mary J. Blige, John Legend, Robin Thicke, Boys to Men, Tina Marie, and an exotic food and vendor marketplace. Tickets are still available at jazzinthegardens.com. That's jazzinthegardens.com.
Next time on The World, animator Sanjay Patel worked on The Simpsons, A Bug's Life, and The Incredibles. As a child, his home was filled with Hindu icons.
There would be all these things to look at, which was the idols of the gods or the illustrations of the gods, and it sort of burned a big impression in my mind.
Cartooning an ancient Hindu story. That's next time on The World.
Join us for The World today at 3 on 91.3 and 91.5 WKWM. A special thank you to our Circle of Friends member, Alice Lucia. Thank you for your generosity to WLRN.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. My guest is psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg, and we're talking about his latest book, Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Gary, is there a website associated with the book? People want more information?
There will be soon. I'm sure it'll be under manufacturingdepression.com, but for now, the best way to get information about it is to go to the website of my publisher, which is simonandschuster.com, and search for Manufacturing Depression. It's right there. But, you know, preferably they'll go to Amazon and look at it there, because then they can click on the link to
buy it. Okay. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and email is open. That's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Before we broke, Gary, you were talking about that you can do less harm by using or abusing these SSRIs than possibly aspirin. But what about effects on kids? These are prescribed for children sometimes, and they haven't been tested on children.
That's
because
right.
They're forbidden to be tested on children.
Well, I don't think it's forbidden. I just think it's difficult to, the hurdle to get over to conduct clinical trials on children, the various hurdles, from the institutional hurdles to the regulatory hurdles to, you know, just the parental hurdles, are substantial. And so there are few studies with children, especially with the young ones. So what that means, that doesn't mean nobody's keeping track. It just means that that we're keeping track in a somewhat haphazard way, and that virtually every child who is taking these drugs is effectively enrolled in a study, because we don't really know yet how these drugs, for instance, affect the growing brain. We don't really know that yet about many drugs that children take, I should add. Central nervous system drugs, like the stimulants that are given for attention deficit disorder. And I think that implicitly we've made the determination that, you know, the cost is worth the benefit, the cost of not knowing.
Can they induce suicidal tendencies among teenagers?
A very, very tricky question. I'm personally not as convinced as some of my colleagues who are critical of the depression industry about this, but then again, I'm not intimately connected with the research. To me, it seems like what the research shows is that there's enough of a signal that it's possible that some of these drugs are associated with increased levels of thoughts and of suicidal thoughts and behavior. But, you know, we have to remember that we're talking about a condition which has as one of its symptoms suicidal thoughts and behavior. It's very tricky to tease out. I would say that increasingly as time goes on, I'm becoming less skeptical, that I think that it is probably, that signal is probably getting stronger, and that the best thing to do, and I know the doctors are doing this because it's a black box warning, is you have to keep very close track of what's going on with your kid, which is a hard thing to do with an adolescent.
I had a woman on this program who had been a salesperson for big pharmaceutical companies, and she's convinced that the same drugs that she pushed on doctors, that her niece committed suicide after being put on these drugs, and she was convinced that it was made worse, I'm sorry, by her taking those drugs, those psychotropic
drugs. Well, without wanting to exacerbate your condition, I would just say that, it doesn't surprise me. Because it's hard to draw these cause and effect lines in something as complex as neurochemistry and mood. These are two separate and very complex phenomena. But if you've got somebody who's emotionally unstable and you give them a central nervous a drug that will alter their consciousness, you're taking a risk. And so I don't know that we can say that the risk is always in the direction of suicide. It might be in the direction of other things, but suicide is obviously the worst possible outcome. And I think in general the risks of these drugs have been way underplayed, from the more benign side effects like the sexual ones I was talking about to the most malignant side effects like suicide. I think in general, these drugs have been sold as magic bullets, as selective, you know, like smart bombs. Just send them down a chimney and they blow up your depression and everything else is cool. I think that's been a little bit overplayed.
Now, have there been clinical studies on these drugs that show that placebos can outperform the antidepressant?
Most of the clinical studies on these drugs show that the placebos outperform the antidepressants. I mean, this is one of the most vexing aspects of this whole phenomenon. The drug companies, I think, never thought that these data would come to light. But what they did was they used a test to validate these drugs for the Food and Drug Administration when they went to clinical trials. They used a test that was invented for the older antidepressants we were talking about earlier. And those drugs, and to validate them in people who were severely depressed. And, you know, 25 years later, when they went to validate these new drugs, they used the same old test, which wasn't really geared very well toward the drugs, and it wasn't geared very well toward the population, because by then, you couldn't do clinical trials just in hospitals. You had to use outpatients. People were less depressed. The depression category had expanded. There were all sorts of reasons that less ill people were in the trials. And so what they ended up with was a set of trials that didn't really pick up what the drugs were actually doing. They just barely squeaked by the scrutiny of the FDA. At one point, an FDA regulator said, you know, these aren't very good results. Maybe we shouldn't approve, I think the drug in question was Celexa. But by then, they'd approved Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, and Effexor. And another regulator said, well, we have to, because as weak as these results are, we've already done it on this basis, and that wouldn't be fair. So, and in the last 10 years, these data have come out, and now people can see that in 37 of the 74 trials, the placebos beat the drugs.
I have an emailer here. This is Steve. He says, Dr. Greenberg, in your book, you seem to suggest that cognitive behavior therapy is a kind of brainwashing. Could you please elaborate?
Well, let me just say, as a therapist, that all therapy, in some ways or other, is a form of brainwashing, in the sense that brainwashing is you're trying to convince a person to feel and think, to approach his mental life differently. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a particular kind of approach to that, in which what's really sold is the idea that it is, as the earlier caller said, it is normative to be happy, that optimism is a sort of a normal state of affairs, and that it is possible to approach all of life's difficulties with a certain amount of what cognitive behavior therapists call neutrality, that is the ability to see them clearly, and resilience. And now, there's hardly anything you can argue with in there, but the implication is that to the extent that you might be pessimistic, that you might be worried about, for instance, things that are going on in the world, that you might be worried about your future, that you might be upset at the, you know, level of debt the United States is carrying, or, you know, any of these issues, troubled by your lack of retirement funds and so on, that to the extent that you're troubled, there's something wrong with you, and this should be corrected by a kind of an approach that amounts to positive thinking.
Let's take a quick call. I've got Eugene in Miami. Hi. Eugene, you're up.
Yes.
Eugene, go on.
Yes, hi. I'm a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, and I have to make a comment, which is that I think the person that's being interviewed is oversimplifying things by separating life events from brain chemistry. And I think that the great problem in understanding the whole issue of depression is that life events and brain chemistry interact in a very complex way, and you cannot separate one or the other. So brain chemistry changes as a result of life events. And one of the failures of these treatments for depression with pharmaceuticals alone is because the treating physician or psychotherapist is not taking into account the person's life events. So I wanted to focus the interviewee in that direction. Thank you.
Okay. I think you kind of agree with him, don't you, Doc?
I totally agree with him. I mean, the problem here is that, in general, the debate about antidepressants and depression breaks down to two oversimplifications. One is, it's all caused by your environment, or the other is, it's all caused by your brain chemicals. And obviously, both of those are fallacious. And what is problematic, however, is that the people who really have power in this discussion, which are the doctors and the pharmaceutical industry, tend to assume, even if they don't state it out loud, that there is a simple linear causal relationship between brain chemistry and your experience, and that is that's what happens when you're depressed, is your brain chemicals just sort of run amok. A guy like the caller makes the really important point that, of course, our experiences change our brain chemistry. We don't have experience without brain chemistry. So if I'm angry, if something makes me angry, it's going to change the way my brain works. But that doesn't mean that my brain just did that all by itself. And what we really risk here, and the caller's a psychoanalyst, and I'm sure he knows the importance of life stories and the way people get to be the people that they are. And I think that's what he's leaning toward. And if I haven't made this really clear, I believe that the real danger of depression understood as a disease is that it diverts our attention from our life stories, both as a sort of something that we come to introspectively, that we understand ourselves, and also as a way of understanding the world around us and our engagements with it and what's wrong with it and what we should do to make it better. And I believe those things can really, yes, they affect brain chemistry. More important, they can really affect your mood. And it would be a shame to make people think that their moods just somehow, you know, arise independently of anything that actually happens. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few cases where that does happen. Those are the people with these severe, protracted, unresponsive depressions. But for the most part, depressions you can trace to people's frustrations, their troubles, their anguish over the realities of their lives.
We're speaking with psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg. We're going to take another short break and be back with more.
And thanks for joining us for Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. If you have questions about our station, 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys, please call this toll-free number, 1-866-740-9596. That's 1-866-740-WKWM. And thanks for listening. Passionate Classics with the Cleveland Orchestra at the Arsht Center. Vladimir Ashkenazy conducts Prokofiev's romantic Romeo and Juliet. And the phenomenal Ingrid Fleeter plays Chopin's tender second piano concerto. For remaining tickets, 305-949-6722 or at arshtcenter.org. March 26th and 27th, Chopin and Romeo and Juliet. The Cleveland Orchestra in residence at the Arsht Center for the Performing Arts.
Is offshore oil and natural gas drilling a good idea in Florida waters? The issue is under debate during this legislative session in Tallahassee. Hello, it's Joseph Cooper. Many who live in coastal areas oppose the idea, but some legislators from inland counties say the economic impact would help fill state coffers. Most agree such drilling wouldn't bring down gas pump prices. Listen for the debate Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
The southernmost air spectacular at Boca Chica Field, Naval Air Station Key West, is April 10th and 11th. It's free and open to the public. There will be appearances by civilian and military performers and the U.S. Navy Flight Demonstration Squadron, the Blue Angels. There will be food, entertainment, and activities for the whole family. The southernmost air spectacular, April 10th and 11th. Details online at wingsoverkeywest.net. That's wingsoverkeywest.net.
And we return 49 minutes past 1 o'clock. We're speaking with psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg about his latest book, Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Let's go back to callers. I've got Jose in Miami. Hey there. Jose, you're up.
Oh, you know what? I wasn't expecting that he would put me on the air.
Well, you're on the air. Do you want to ask a question? Or shall I go elsewhere?
Actually, no, yeah, you know what? Yeah, you go elsewhere.
Okay. Jeff in Miami. Hi there. Jeff.
Yeah, oh, hi, Joseph.
You're killing me here.
Thank you for a great program, and my brain chemistry was changing as I was anticipating going on the air. I have a comment. I once heard that the opposite of depression is vitality, so that, you know, the obstacles that you meet in life can be met, you know, you have the readiness to meet obstacles. But that's just a comment. My question really is this. Are antidepressants meant to be used short-term or long-term? I'm not on antidepressants. Maybe I should be. I don't know. But I wonder what... I have met a number of people who've been on antidepressants for years, and I'm just wondering what the impact goes to their psychological condition and their actual clinical condition.
Well, let him answer that.
Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean... I don't think there is a single answer to that. I believe that most doctors start out with a very moderate and reasonable position that let's try this drug and see what happens. To people who are reluctant to take them, they'll explain, well, I think you have a biochemical imbalance, and maybe this drug will, you know, get you back together, and then you won't have to take it very long. So I don't think very few people go into it thinking that I'll be on this for the rest of my life. But I have to say that an awful lot of people end up on antidepressants for a very long time because, first of all, they like the way they feel on the drugs better than they like the way they felt off the drugs.
Does one develop a tolerance for a particular drug?
Well, you know, not in the same way that you do for speed or alcohol, but, yeah, you can. What happens is that it's called the Prozac poop out. It's got a fancy medical name, too, but, you know, the more vulgar name, you know, tells you what you need to know. And so then what happens is you switch antidepressants or you up the dose. And it also has a fairly pronounced withdrawal syndrome, which is that you stop taking the drugs and you start to feel lousy. And some people experience these what they call brain shocks, where there's a sort of feeling of electrical activity in your brain and other unpleasantnesses. And just you don't like the way you feel. And often these are relieved, these effects are relieved by taking the drug again, which with most other drugs, you would call that addiction. You don't call it addiction with these drugs because I think... to be fair, I don't think you call it addiction because these aren't really drugs of abuse. People don't take them to get high the same way they take coke. But they do have these syndromes associated with them. And I think that people where this idea that it's a biochemical imbalance comes in really handy for people and for drug companies and for doctors is by saying, well, your disease was a biochemical imbalance and this drug is like insulin for a diabetic. It corrects the hormonal problem.
If someone listening right now is in severe depression, maybe even thinking suicide, what should they do right now? Who should they
call?
Go to the emergency
room. Yeah, I mean, you know, if somebody is that severely racked by depression that they're thinking about killing themselves, I don't know, the emergency room, they should get themselves some help. They should call somebody that they trust. They should call a hotline if they have to. They should call their doctor. They should go to the emergency room. They should treat that as any other kind of medical emergency. When you find yourself thinking about killing yourself, I don't care if it's a disease or not, the best way to think about that, given the way our world works, is to think of it as a medical emergency and to treat it as such.
Mm-hmm. And how is your depression faring these days?
I've been doing pretty well. Writing the book was quite a challenge, and...
That was my next question. Was writing the book therapeutic in some way?
It was in some ways. And you know, on the other hand, no writer escapes the difficulties of writing or the difficulties of what happens after your book comes out. And I have to say that, being the sensitive sort, there have definitely been days when I felt all of those 9 criteria. And that's just, I think in some ways, you just have to be sort of stoical about who you are and how your character or your brain chemistry work. Sometimes it's just a matter of persisting.
Do you feel you're more empathetic with your patients?
Because of writing the book?
Because of suffering from depression myself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when somebody comes in and says to me, tells me something that makes me think that they're depressed, I can sort of picture what that feels like very, very closely, and also have a sense of what else might be going on for them. And people, when you say, oh, so you're feeling this way, so I wonder if you're feeling that way, and they were, and they haven't associated it before, they find that very powerful.
They feel some hope if somebody recognizes a symptom or tells them why they're feeling a symptom.
Exactly. I mean, empathy is probably the single most important factor that makes psychotherapy a healing practice.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour that we've spent. My guest has been psychotherapist and journalist Gary Greenberg, and his latest book is Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease, and he joined us from his home in Connecticut, where he actually is a practicing psychotherapist. Gary Greenberg, thank you very much for coming on our program.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this interview.
Okay. And that's today's program. My apologies to those callers I couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical supervision by Bonnie Berman, and Sammy Mack handled our calls. Exacerbate. Comments, questions, or suggestions go to rives@wlrn.org. And tomorrow we get into the sticky issue of offshore drilling for oil and natural gas in Florida. It's a topic of debate in the legislative session in Tallahassee. There's opposition from tourist-dependent areas and support from inland Republican legislators. And to the calendar. On this day in 1943, 67 years ago, the birth of actor Joe Pesci in Newark, Raging Bull, Easy Money, Once Upon a Time in America, Goodfellas, and My Cousin Vinny. Also on this day in 1945, 65 years ago, the birth of actress Mia Farrow in L.A. After a big role in TV's Peyton Place, she starred in 1968's Rosemary's Baby and appeared, of course, in many Woody Allen films. She now lives in Soho, New York, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. And on this day in 1969, 41 years ago, the death of Gabby Hayes in Los Angeles. You're a no-good side-winding, bush-whacking, horn-swaggling, cracker-croaker. He was a John Wayne sidekick 20 times, but was born in upstate New York. He first rode a horse at age 40. And we leave with a line from Joe Pesci's murderous Goodfellas character, Tommy DeVito. I'm funny how? Like a clown? I'm here to amuse you? Get ready to take a ride. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for Neil Conan and the Talk of the Nation from where else but NPR News.